The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 295 for Wednesday, the 19th of October, 2011. My name is Jules Cisek. I'm here in California with Jim Race. Hey, Jim.
Hey, also in California myself.
Yep.
And it really doesn't change that often, Jules, except for when we kind of pop out of the country, but we seem to be fairly well-placed these days here in the States.
Correct. And I'll do the honors this week. Let's see if this works.
Indeed.
All right. So the only errata we have from last week is my apologies for the little 125 predictions, which were kind of pointless, as Martin pointed out, since they were based on riders that were actually Moto2 this year. So that's the errata for last week. Let's go to listener feedback, because we had a lot of really good stuff. Obviously, a lot of stuff happened over the weekend at Phillip Island. It was a very strange weekend. A lot of stuff happened, and so we got a lot of feedback. The first thing I'm going to read is Paul Harris.
Hey, Jules, can I just interrupt you before we even dive into that? We should probably explain what happened before we start talking about...
Okay, sounds good.
Talking about...
Sounds
so,
good.
So, two things. But the primary one that we're going to drop into very quickly is that in warm-up on Sunday, Jorge Lorenzo crashed out into the little bit of a pseudo-high side through the gravel trap, but on the way through... his hand was caught underneath his left handlebar as he went off course, and this caused a serious injury. And so we got a lot of feedback about that, and that's what you're going to dive into now.
Yeah, and obviously there was a huge talking point, because all Casey Stoner had to do at that point was finish sixth. Actually, it was funny because but on Twitter, immediately people start tweeting, Casey Stoner, you know, world champion, Jorge Lorenzo will not be racing. And then myself and a bunch of other people started pointing out, well, actually, he still has to finish sixth in order to clinch it. But, you know, as we know what happened this weekend, it wasn't difficult for Casey to do that. So anyway, so the first listener feedback is from Paul Harris. This was actually on Facebook. He says, wow, that sucks. And this is talking about the Jorge Lorenzo incident. The rush of blood numbs everything up, so he will be okay until that wears off. However, he will be medicated by that time. The tip of his middle finger. I wonder how that will affect his lever control. I lost my pinky at T2 at Barber back in March. Not fun. Ugly side of the sport. Hope they can sew his tip back on. Yeah. They did, actually, because we got a Yamaha press release which said that at the Knox Private Hospital in Victoria, they did a operative diagnosis was left hand ring and middle finger injuries, because he actually also had injuries to his middle finger. He had dislocated it and lost some skin off of it, and so his middle finger wound, skin loss only, covered by SSG, what is that? Some kind of skin graft taken from...
Yeah, it was a skin graft from his palm, which if you think about that is nearly as bad. Try growing the skin back on your palm to grip a lever or grip a hand grip.
Right. Yuck. And then the ring finger wound was a longitudinal dorsal grinding injury with loss of tip, distal half of the distal phalanx missing, and the extensor tendon was identified and reattached. Now, this is the part that like freaked me out when I read that. Identified and reattached, you know? Because another thing that was kind of like a storm on Twitter was when journalists were saying that the marshals and the even the mechanics went back to the place where he crashed looking for something.
Well, you certainly want to grab any any proprietary bits of the bike, but proprietary bits of your rider as well.
Wow.
I'm just saying, you know, it's a one-off part. We got some more stuff back. Rose on our follow-up from last week said it was interesting hearing someone other than myself describing digging fingers in the pavement to slow the slide before the inevitable crash with the wall. I've done that, going into turn 7 at Sears Point. Really fun at about 100 miles an hour. That was my interjection.
Slide it for a long time there, too.
I did. That was when I decided to lock up the front brake on my bike and didn't know it until I turned in. It was a little surprising. It really does sound crazy, but then so does racing between stone walls. On the other hand, motor racing in general may just be inherently crazy, and this is Rose Runner continuing. In a way, humans require nobody hit anything solid all weekend at Phillip Island, and I will point out that that's because a lot of people avoided hitting things solid by dumping it before they hit things. Yet there were many injuries, and I will interject again, Jules. I think a lot of the injuries that happen at Phillip Island are because of the nature of the gravel traps. That's something that's been talked about for years. They're not quite...
That's true.
They call them gravel traps, but they're more like larger stone-ish traps. Continuing on, it says...
And actually, somebody did hit something sort of solid. We'll talk about that later with the Marquez.
Yep. Continuing on, I race motorcycles for 25 years and have been thinking about what we do a lot. For me, the bottom line is guys do dangerous stuff, so sometimes we get hurt. We are evolved to go out and engage in life or death struggles with critters every day in order to bring home the kicking, screaming, fang-equipped bacon, after all. Ben Bostrom said, I lose my edge unless I do something dangerous every day. He also pointed out that he may get hurt occasionally while racing, while football players get injured every time they play.
Yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, that's true. And actually, you know, I have a friend of mine at work who does some fairly extreme sports, and he came back from a kite surfing expedition, and he was with a guy who did some base jumping in New Zealand a few months ago, and 4 out of the 12 base jumpers died, you know, during that trip. And he says it's not that uncommon. Like anyway, we do some crazy stuff out there, you know, for thrills or for whatever reason.
I think I'd rather just race motorcycles, frankly, than have a 1/3 chance of getting jacked up.
Yeah, exactly what I was thinking.
Or permanently jacked up. Moving on, should I go forward?
Yep.
All right, Robert Crowley wrote in, hey, Motopod, after watching BSB live at Brands, who knows, I love those too, who needs MotoGP? It's just being blown away by Moto2. Also at Brands, saw the youngest ever 125 GP champion, Kyle Ride, crowned. Cool. What an incredible kid. What is going on in the rookie selection, this being Red Bull Rookies Cup for next year? Not a single American made the cut, and only one Brit. Is that a sniff of politics I detect with the selectors, or is it just me being cynical? And just before we started to do the show, Jules popped out a couple of emails, and I know that Joe Roberts, he's an American, is going to make it in. And I forget the name of the Brit, and my apologies to our Brit listeners, but we've got at least one in there, maybe two.
Well, Robert Crowley is from Britain, and so he should know.
Well, yeah. I mean, that being said, each year, Red Bull Rookies is different. There's no doubt that to actually attend these tryouts, I mean, you know, this year it was over to Aragon. You know, you got to fly your family over, take care of all this stuff. It's about money. And if they're doing the tryouts in Spain, where are most of the riders going to come from?
Right. That's true.
And you mentioned, Jules, that talked about the American Red Bulls Rookies Cup that we had for a couple of years, which is went away at the end of 2009. And so we haven't had that to feed more Americans in. It is what it is. If the economy picks up, if things come back, we'll have to see how it goes. But that is the situation right now.
Yep. And by the way, Robert Crowley is a longtime listener to the show, and he's very he follows the the young writers in all the different series very closely. So he knows a lot about this stuff. And so, Robert, you should write in more about maybe some up and coming writers that we should be looking out for, names, you know, where they're from. Robert and I've actually exchanged some non-electronic mail, which we refer to as snail mail here in the States. And I guess you post in the UK is what you guys call it. Which is really the kind of a refreshing way to communicate with people, you know. Anyway, last one is from Dan Osborne. He writes, with Stoner winning the championship, he becomes the first writer to repeat as champion in the premier class with three full seasons between championships, 2008, 2009, 2010. This is on the heels of Rossi in 2009 becoming the only the second champion in the premier class to repeat after two full seasons between championships. In 60 years of racing in the premier class from 1949 to 2008, only once has a rider repeated as a champion with more than just one season between them winning the title. But now that has happened twice in the last 3 years. What are your thoughts on why? Are riders taking better care of themselves, allowing them to ride at a higher level longer into their careers? Are there more championship-level riders competing, making it tougher for a rider to win back-to-back titles? I think there's truth to both of those things, but the main thing I think is just that the tracks have gotten so much safer that's what really helps the longevity of the riders. And you know, I'm not talking about, you know, longevity of their lives, but just injuries used to take out riders way earlier in their careers, right? Maybe people used to race with hail bales, you know, and stone walls, you know, that we talked about earlier. And it wasn't really until the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, that writers like Kenny Roberts and Reddy Mamola started to really kind of fight for safer conditions for the riders. You know, before that, it was kind of by boycott. Certain riders, like, for example, Agostini, refused to race at the Isle of Man because it was so different from the other tracks they were at and all the dangers that it posed. So I think that is a really big part. And I think the other part is also true, right? I mean, we've got these aliens right now, all capable of winning the championship, given the right circumstance. We got, you know, Rossi, who just needs a bike that is exactly like the Yamaha he left. we've got Casey Stoner, who is on form, you know, that we have not seen him before yet. He may not even have reached his potential yet. We got Danny Pedrosa, who may have missed his chance to really win a world championship, but you never know, right? You never know what will happen. And obviously, Lorenzo is not going away. So then we've got up-and-coming guys. You know, we've got Mark Marquez, who in a lot of ways is starting to remind me of Rossi from 10 years to, well, 12 years ago, 13 years ago. So the answer is yes.
Right. do you want to hear my postulation on it? That when I originally read it, the email from Dan, I started thinking about it. I'm like, huh, okay. There may be something else. And I think what that something else is, at least to me, is over the last, let's say 15 years, is the never-ending shift in the class structures and rules. And I think that actually makes a big difference based upon the way that the factories have to constantly make adjustments to try and put forth competitive machinery as well as the economics that have gone into MotoGP. And if you start thinking about that, Jules, your head's going to spin.
No, that is a great, great point, Jim. That's absolutely another variable in this, because when, I mean, 2007 is a perfect example. Everybody got completely, you know, totally surprised by Ducati coming out with a very unbeatable package in the beginning of the season, you know, and this year with Honda and their clutch, you know, that was such a big talking point in the beginning. I don't know if you guys even remember, because there was so much that happened this week this year that it's, you look back at what we were talking about at the beginning of the season, it's kind of like, wow, I completely forgot. Yeah, that's right. There used to be this thing about this clutch, you know, and so it's technology, but the main thing is the formula. Like you said, the formula changing is a really huge factor. It's absolutely true.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, if you notice, when the Moto 3 rules came out, they very specifically said no auto shifting clutches, which was a response to what Honda developed at the beginning of the year.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
But it's such a combinatory state of things, and so if you take what Dan said, and you go back further, there was a lot of rule stability for a fair amount of time. Not literally, the rules have been in turmoil for about the last 12 to 15 years, 13 years maybe.
Yeah.
And that I personally think that has presented the series with a kind of a conundrum, in that it becomes a series and riders and teams, it becomes a little bit difficult to react. And there was a lot of teams this year, Jules, that we speculated last year on if teams were going to attack this season. We certainly said that Honda wanted to win the world, an 800cc championship, and they certainly did, right? In grand style, both rider and manufacturer.
And team, it looks like, too.
And team. And what other teams might be doing to prepare themselves for 2012.
Which is a completely new formula, and the other, yeah. Then there was the control tires, right, where we went from riders that were Michelin riders suddenly riding on Bridgestones. There were very few that were able to make that switch easily. It took some of the riders a little bit to get used to it, right? Stoner was already on them, so he kind of had an edge. Other riders did not, so it's totally true. This mucking around with the rules definitely made for interesting times.
Sure.
Never mind. I was going to talk more about that. Well, no, it's just injuries in general, because of the safety of the tracks and, just medical advances too. Right. These guys have some of the most high-tech equipment right there available. The moment they get taken off the track, they're in Clinica Mobile being treated by some of the best doctors that know about this sport, the kind of injuries that this sport receives. They get flown directly to hospitals that have dealt with these injuries much more than in the past. So, it's just so many variables that I think add up to it. In general, I think, though, that the formula variable may actually be the biggest one.
It very well could be.
Great question, Dan. It's a great question.
Yeah, and I have a feeling it'll spur an awful lot more listener email going forward.
Yeah, good.
And tweets and Facebook posts. You guys feel free to send in to us. We're only our personal opinions, but we would certainly like to hear what you think. Yep. And going into we're drifting towards our off season here. We know that World Superbike's done and MotoGP is kind of heading down that way. Just a few races left. Love to talk to you guys. So, did we cover that in full, Jules?
Yes, but we might as well jump right into, since you were talking about the formula. I just wanted to mention the really fantastic series that Dennis Noyes is writing right now. He's on part 3 of 4 as we record this call about CRTs, and so I'll bet you
anything. Dennis is in the middle of part 4 of 4 as we speak. So yeah, late night guy.
Yep. And so we're looking forward to that, to the conclusion. I thought part 3 was actually the most fascinating one, where he's doing the lap comparisons between World Superbikes and MotoGP and speculating on where CRTs might be and why. And I did want to just read one quote from the first part, which is where Dennis says, I respect and share the opinion of those who say that MotoGP should not dumb down in order to improve the show. But I also remember what Bernie Ecclestone said to Carmelo Ezpeleta over dinner at Donington Park in 1992. I think I can recall just about the exact words. I was working in Dorna back in the early days. One thing I know, this is him quoting Ecclestone. One thing I know that I have learned is that you must never permit the manufacturers, especially the Japanese manufacturers, to have their way with the rule book because they think like competitors, which is all well and good for them, but they know absolutely nothing about the business of professional motorsports. That's a really, really good quote because I know a lot of you know, journalists that we talk to, you know, they really position Dorna and IRTA and even the FIM kind of as one side, and then the MSMA, the Motorcycle Manufacturers Association, as the other. You know, and over so many years, the MSMA seems to have had the upper hand in pushing the technical part of the sport, the technical rules of the sport. This is interesting because, you know, this is probably the most the biggest gamble that Dorna has taken with the CRTs, pretty much in the history of the sport, you know.
Well,
two maybe, totally different formulas in the same class. Well, not totally different because there's many rules that cover the same bits, but clearly two different classes, right?
I think you're running out on a limb here. I seem to remember when we had a crossover of the four strokes and two strokes, not only at the beginning of the.
Yeah, but that was not. I mean, we're not transitioning to CRT bikes in 2013. I mean, 2002 was just a transition year. It was a year where you were allowed to race two strokes, and just like now, in 2012, you were allowed to race 800s. They're just considered factory bikes. Therefore, you're covered by the factory rules. You don't get any of the benefits of the CRTs.
Well, and, I'm actually going back further when we had two-stroke to four-stroke transitions and four-stroke transitions where they knocked back the level of technology back in the late 60s and early 70s. I mean, we've had maybe not as grandiose in such a rapid fashion as we've had over the last 10 or 12 years, but we have had a lot of major changes over the years. Now, obviously not with Dorna in charge all the way, but FIM has certainly made major changes to the sport as time has gone on.
I still argue that this experiment is. I'm not saying that it's the biggest change. I think it's the riskiest.
It could be, but then again, the time for risk is now.
I'm so glad. I'm glad. I'm really glad. I want to, because fail or not, it'll shake out for the better. I think. I really do think it'll shake out for the better.
You know what? I have to chuckle because if I look at you and I and talking back 2 or 3 years ago, I think both of us were like adamant, God damn it, there's going to be no changes. I'm tired of changes.
yeah. Well, you know, I mean, we want to see better racing. We want to see fuller grids. There's so much danger of the grids continuing to shrink. I think that if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't even be talking about the CRTs. We wouldn't even know what they are. And, you know, it would never have come up in the first place. We wouldn't have needed them. But given the state of affairs, this is a really... interesting experiment. I think it's a really interesting experiment. I hope it works.
Okay, let me postulate something to you, Jules, and to everybody out there. What if, and I love what ifs, didn't we name a show like that? Was that the last show or the show before?
The show before, yeah.
Yeah. What if trees suddenly grow money, And the economy picks up drastically. You know, motorcycle sales peak through the roof on every continent. And we have a flood of money back into the sport. What happens then, Jules?
I don't know. We change the rules again, most likely. you know who's going to... If you follow the money, I'm just waiting for Harley Davidson to announce going into GP, because they are doing just fine. I believe that their sales have exceeded expectations again this quarter. So,
I think you're pushing it now.
Harley Davidson, MotoGP, woohoo! All right. So enough about that. Let's go into. Oh, you had something else to say? Sorry.
I think we could leave it at that.
Okay. Yeah. Before the call, we were saying, this is probably going to be a quick show because we've got very tight notes.
Yeah, so no.
We're just getting to the fourth paragraph of the 20.
All right. Well, so I should say before this that I did not, and so Jules and I kind of have tag teamed this week because both of us have been incredibly busy over the weekend, though we tried to watch as much racing as we could. Jules caught the most and took the most notes along with Martin of MotoGP. So I'm going to kind of let you lead that, Jules. I kind of tried to do my best with World Superbike, which we had the season closer at Portimao, and I'll crank on there. But Jules, I think you drive through here, and I'll throw in my usual bitter commentary.
Bitter? Sounds good. All right. Well, first of all, there's some news, right? So silly season is now is hotting up. And it's actually at the team level that it's really getting interesting. First off, Aspar is not going to be fielding Ducati next year. They still want to do two bikes, but instead they're going to go as a CRT team. Which combination is not for sure yet, but I believe it's the BMW suitor, right? I know they approached Aprilia. Actually, they approached Aprilia first, didn't they? Because,
to be honest, I have no idea where they're heading at this point. I've read so many conflicting reports.
Let's not speculate too much. But I just kind of think it'd be kind of a kick in Ducati's ass if they went to Aprilia. But basically, citing the fact that the Ducati wanted way too much for the satellite bikes for the price of one bike, they can easily run two riders.
Sure.
So they're going to be a CRT experiment, which is cool in a way, because that's a very, very good, well-funded team. We have absolutely no word on what has going on with Elias, Rene Depounier, or Alvaro Bautista, because we still don't know about what's going on with Suzuki, although Tommy Hill was talking to British Eurosport on Sunday. And when he was asked about him and John Hopkins joining the Suzuki team in World Superbikes in 2012, he said that Hopper has signed a MotoGP deal. So that's interesting. Oops. Because if Suzuki stays, they're definitely going to have Alvaro Bautista on board.
I think so, unless he ends up at Aspar instead.
It is possible. I mean, they have worked together before. Yep. But if Suzuki is going to be on board with a 1,000cc bike, then that's really good news, because we do want maximum factories in there.
Totally.
And then David Emmett was reporting that Danilo Petrucci, who is the World Superbike Super Stock runner up for the season, has signed with a team that we haven't actually heard of before, Giampiero Sacchi's CRT team for 2012, which is. There's a
Did
lot
they
of
come out of they come out of the CEV championship, I believe, or CIV, the Italian championship.
Oh yes. You're right. The Spanish one. You're right. The CEV. Yep. And actually, the part of this article from Dennis Noyes in the CRTs speculates on the riders and how, you know, aside from Colin Edwards. You're going to be surprised with some of the names that you'll see on the CRT bikes. They're not names you hear very often. You know, they're like, you know, guys who finished 13th or 14th in Moto2, guys from local championships. And I think it may be that it'll take a season before bigger names start joining those teams. But we'll see. We don't, you know, the lineup is very open still. There's a lot of riders that are still looking for rides. So
no doubt,
we shall see.
Do you have the impression that silly season might actually extend past the first race of next year?
Exactly. I totally think that. It could very well be that there'll be, they have to have some things finalized, but the CRTs are being given a lot of leeway because some of these teams don't even have like an engine manufacturer lined up or a chassis manufacturer lined up. They just have sponsors, you know, that have given them a handshake, you know? So, and because we don't want the grid to shrink, I think that both Dorn and FIM will be very lenient at the beginning of the season.
I think so too. Yep. No doubt.
And of course, the big one is Marquez. It's called a conference at the end of the week. Unfortunately, we have not gotten to the end of the week yet. But the speculation, because we love to be interesting to have heard that. But Julian Ryder is speculating that Marc Marquez is going to announce that he's moving to MotoGP. And here's a really interesting thing, because now there's there was a tweet from Azzy Farney from MotoGP, from Dorna, that says that when she talked to Marquez, he was not even aware that there was going to be a conference. Of course, he could be bluffing or whatever. But the interesting thing is that the FIM released the team's list for that were accepted for Moto3 and Moto2 classes for 2012. There are 20 teams in each class representing 32 entries, and the Moto2 class does not have a Repsol team.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it doesn't have a Repsol name to it.
No, I know. But I went through these names, and I don't see any name here that is not already associated with an existing team, and it's not the CX Repsol that Marquez is running with.
You are an overbelieving individual, Jules.
I'm just saying that's the only other thing we know so far, right?
All right. I'll work with you on this.
And finally, Mark VDS, who were working with BMW Suter, and they were actually even had bikes on track at Brno at Misano for a CRT entry, is now being rumored to be running Ducati, which may be the Ducati that was being offered to the Aspar team, and with Scott Redding aboard. Now, that's the Scott Redding in MotoGP actually makes a lot of sense to me. I think he's a big boy, and I think that he could do pretty well in the bigger class.
I think so too. And frankly, the Mark VDS squad, considering how many irons they have in the fire, are very capable of putting together a large, well-backed squad to do that. Now,
they race, you know, cars.
Everything.
They race rally. they race Le Mans. They race motorcycles in many different series. So, absolutely.
So
I think they even race boats, don't they?
They do race boats. Here's a question that I have to ask. And that I frankly think is very important. Although, shit, I mean, is it really going to matter next year? And okay, this is the question is negated by the circumstance that we have no idea what the bikes are going to be capable of next year. Is the 2012 Ducati going to be anything like the 2011? I believe the answer for that is who the fuck knows? Yeah. We don't know. We have no idea.
Yeah, that includes Ducati.
Yeah. Truthfully, and
yeah, no, I'm not being flippant. I'm being serious.
Yeah. Holy crap! I have no idea. And you know what? This is kind of the fun thing. This silly season is especially silly, and frankly, it's stupid in a way. Because going into next year, and I guess I'm sure we did this when we went from 990s to 800s and two strokes to four strokes, but And we were probably, if we went back and listened, oh my God, we'd probably hate ourselves for the stupid things that we said. But we've really got no idea. And we understand, the bottom line is that a well-funded team and a well-funded and well-manned effort and womaned effort will certainly get the job done regardless. I still think we've got no idea, Jules. I mean, maybe going through winter testing, we'll have some idea.
We won't even know after Qatar, because we'll have a hint of Qatar. But as we were talking earlier this year, Qatar is such a one-off race. Nobody really develops a bike to race a Qatar. They develop it for the first European round.
Well, wait a minute. Didn't they move Qatar to not be the first race this year? Or was that... Am I missing?
No, it's still okay. The first year. The first one.
Okay. Was that World Superbike? I forget. Anyway. That's right. That's right. They moved the test from Qatar to Jerez.
Exactly. Because the test is pointless in Qatar. Yeah. So
all right,
that's a good...
Continue forward, sir.
All right. So, Phillip Island, as we mentioned last show... Rider's favorite, and it's a track that has some very unusual characteristics, and there was a very, very interesting press release from Bridgestone after the race, in which Bridgestone always makes this release that kind of explains kind of what happened, what they were thinking going in, from the tire manufacturer's perspective. But they were talking about, you know, the bumpiness of the track, which happened just over a year after year due to basically atmospheric phenomenon and weather, and the fact that, you know, even though we actually had fairly warm temperatures on race day, because of the constant wind, you get these cooling effects, and the wind really played a huge part in the smaller classes, especially the 125s, because there was a tailwind during QP, there was a headwind during one of the free practices, and so it's hard to really gauge your setup because you're going such different speeds. I mean, those little bikes get really affected by, and like I think you were saying last week that you expected to see a lot of, you know, drilled out fairings, and yeah, there were a lot of drilled out fairings, especially in the smaller classes. But Johann Zarco, who was coming off a win at Motegi, took pole in 125s, and Nicholas Tirol was way down. I mean, he was fourth. He was on second row, so that was unusual. And the actual race was very strange. 125s. I always kind of find it kind of. Interesting that the lightest bike usually have to deal with the weirdest weather, because in the morning as the day kind of starts to warm up is when you get the biggest winds and the biggest changes in chances of rain. And sure enough, they had wind, they had rain. Some of the riders opted out to start the race on wets. Obviously, not the championship contenders. And Zarco had a very good race, whereas Tirol did not have a very good race. So the guy that was really a fly in the ointment for Zarco was Sandro Cortesi, because he took off and just started to disappear. He was setting amazing laps from the very beginning. Won the race easily. What was the final? He had 13 seconds. But the guy that I think caused the most trouble for Zarco was actually his teammate, Efren Vasquez. And it made me really think, like, you know what the problem with Zarco is? He's just not Spanish enough. Because it's, you know, it's like he's competing in a class that's dominated by Spaniards, and even his teammates, like, you know, and knowing that the championship is on the line, it wasn't just that he was racing with him. Fine, race him, pass him, great, but he was racing with him to, you know, I don't know, it's great to see that there are no team orders, but. Finally, Vasquez backed off, and I think somebody must have said something to him on the boards, because he was really attacking Zarco hard, and all of a sudden he kind of backed off. Tirol did make it up to sixth, So he was doing damage limitations, but the guy that really was kind of a surprise, and remember, I did say he was going to be somebody to contend with last week because he likes these kinds of tracks, just these flat, fast flowing tracks on 125s, and that's Louis Salom. And
hey, do me a favor.
Yeah.
You just said something that I thought was interesting. You said that Zarco, somebody must have said something to him on the boards, and that's why he did what he did. What do you mean by that?
I mean Vasquez.
Or I'm sorry, Vasquez. Yeah.
Yeah, because they were fighting, and you know, they're teammates.
Right.
And it didn't look like Vasquez had a moment. But all of a sudden, Zarco was clear of him. They were battling, and I was just holding my head like, that team is not going to be happy with Vasquez, which is not the first time we've had this kind of story with Vasquez. I mean, he was Tirol's. Was he Tirol? No, he was with Paul Espargaro, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Last year. Anyway, they would, you know. The AirAsia team guys must have been like, WTF, right? Back off. So
why can't you say what the fuck?
Oh, I can say what the fuck. I think WTF is also a way to say it. All right, so, Zarco only got third, which meant that he only gained 6 points on Tirol instead of 10. Courtesy of Louis Salom. And that means that going into this next round of Sepang, Nicholas Tirol, all he has to do to win the championship, because he's going in with 25 points, all he has to do is finish ahead of Zarco. And if they both, for some reason, don't finish, he still wins the championship at Sepang. So it's going to be up to Zarco. Now, he's been in fantastic form. You know, he went into Phillip Island previously. I think his previous finish there was like 11th or something, and he qualified on pole and finished third. So Zarco's still at it.
Have you had any doubt since about the middle of the season that Tirol was probably going to win the 125cc, the last one, 125cc championship?
I have, actually, but it was the beginning of the season was where we were like, oh my God, what a runaway, because he won like the first three or four races. It was Maverick Vinales and Zarco that were kind of trading for the other podium positions. And Tirol looked like he was just going to clear off because he was the only contender to Marc Marquez last year. It was only about mid-season that I was like, well, not mid-season, but let's say a third into the season that Zarco started to really show up on the board, and people started scratching their heads going, ah, check it out, you know?
True.
Right, so Sandro Cortese is now third as a result of that win, and Maverick Vinales slips to fourth, but he's 7 points behind. I would like to see Vinales. We haven't really heard that much from him. He finished this race in eighth place, which is a kind of unusual place for him. Now, this race was stopped early. That was the other thing that was kind of crazy about the whole Vasquez situation is because the previous lap, Vasquez had crossed, I mean, two laps before the race was called, he had crossed the line before Zarco. And so if they had just stopped the race like one lap earlier, then Vasquez would have been third and Zarco would have lost a further, 2 points or 3 points. So
what are we in what if part two here?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yep.
So something to point out to listeners, if you've not, you know, stuck with us this long or for the last 8 years or whatever, is that 125s are not a flag-to-flag race. Or are they? Or am I, like, speaking out of my ass? But they're not currently a flag-to-flag race, much like MotoGP is. And so they have a tendency to call the races earlier if they've completed the requisite number of laps required. Requisite required in the same sense. That's horrible, Jim.
And if they don't, then they do a sprint race based on the position of the racers.
A full restart. And the thing that we've complained about often, and the thing we've probably seen most often, Jules, at Phillip Island.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to the star of the week, which is
Moto 2 was kind of you enjoyed Moto 2. I thought it was kind of boring. There didn't seem like there was much action, no passing or anything like that. we can just move on, talk about something else.
Yeah, the action started right from the very beginning in FP1 when Marquez fell about halfway through the session and demolished his bike. And it took he didn't demolish his bike, I believe he ground down the side of it so much that it lost oil in the gravel, and you know they had to basically rebuild a whole bunch of stuff.
But he still had the
original Suter Flame at this point. But it took to the end of the session for him to rebuild it.
Let me see if I can fill in some salient points here. He choked an engine. B, he basically nearly pretzeled the frame, and they managed to get it back. So remember that key, that his engine was gone, and he had to use another. And he beat the crap out of the frame to the point where he ended up going out with about a minute and a quarter.
Well, that's what I was getting at. It took them a long time to put something together that he could ride. He went out to test it, but there was only a minute left, which meant that, you know, he wasn't going to be able to get a full, you know, warm up lap and then a hot lap.
Right.
So when the checkered flag flew for the session, he went past the finish line and kept at pace. And then in the Southern Loop, unfortunately, there were two riders there that were already slowed down. They were on their slowdown lap. In fact, they looked like they were talking to each other. And he avoided the first guy. I don't remember who that was, but then he slammed into the back of Rathaport Willerot. And that was a nasty, 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 nasty crash.
Yes, it was.
And actually, it's amazing because Rathaport is... he had some lesions on the back of his legs, and he had to be taken out to the hospital. He missed a race as a result of his injuries, but nothing really major. So unbelievably lucky, because you know
and when they took him to the hospital and kept him in overnight, they were actually very concerned about some possibilities to some of the discs in his back, which as it turned out. Wasn't necessarily the case, but he got pounded into the tarmac by...
Pounded,
yeah.
Actually, Marquez was lucky to be... What did that remind you of, by the way? The first thing I thought of after going, holy shit, was Laguna Seca and Schobert.
Oh, yeah, Bubba Schobert. Yeah.
Yeah,
nearly the same thing. I do want to say that... because I've watched the Marquez Willerot incident probably 20 times now, and I can actually see how up to a point he could not have seen the other rider. Yeah, it was a left turn, and there was a rider behind Willerot and on the inside, and if they're both at lean, you could lose the other rider. Now that being said, that's not an excuse for Marquez being at, and a lot of people said he was at full song, and I don't believe he was. You could see that as well, that he was.
The moment he saw the other rider, he slowed down, but he was going to thread the needle, kind of, you know.
Yeah, well, I think there was no, I think that was a solid needle at that point.
But he didn't know that. He didn't know that. I mean, I don't want to dwell about it too much. It's really great that there weren't any major, major injuries, and we wish that to see Rathaport at Sepang, you know.
Yeah.
But
and we do. And that being said, we do have an awful lot still left to talk about, don't we?
Yeah, because as a result of this, race direction decided to penalize Marquez for reckless. activity. I forget what the term was that they used. And they
I think it might have actually been reckless activity.
And they penalized him with a 1-minute penalty, which is basically just saying you're going to start at the back of the grid, no matter what happens during qualifying.
And let's be clear, because a lot of people were wondering about this too. Whatever his qualifying time was going to be, there would be a minute added on to it. That being said, if he qualified with his qualifying time prior to the 1-minute penalty, he would certainly still be added to the grid because he qualified within the 107% rule. But then they pop a minute on that, and he would still get to run the race, certainly from the back, though.
Right, right, yeah. Right. Well, the other thing that happened was that he destroyed the 2012 frame that he's been testing and using for the second half of the season, and he had to go back to the original, the 2011 frame that everybody else is racing on for the next two practices.
But then a knight in shining armor came through in the form of
Aspar. Yeah, who had a 2012 frame that they weren't using themselves, which is kind of strange. But I guess they weren't ready for it yet. They have to do some testing with it. And they gave the frame to them. Obviously, some money must have exchanged some hands, you know. But, so Marquez did have the 2012 frame not for qualifying, I don't believe. Actually, no, he did have it for qualifying. Because they used qualifying to return to his setup that he had when he was doing FP1.
The whole thing's pretty. It's got a whole bunch of intrigue to it, and actually, hopefully, when and I'm not sure that when Julian, and I have to go back and look, and my apologies to Mr. Ryder, but when Julian Ryder covers the year in review, is he only do MotoGP as also?
No, he has a section on Moto2 and 125s at the end of the books, and they're very, very interesting.
I want to read, because he's kind of free at that point to give his personal opinion in more depth, and he's always got a bit of insight. So curious.
Right. So if this show seems a little patchy, by the way, this is now the second time that Skype has crashed for me, and we're experiencing some technical difficulties. Anyway, moving on. So obviously the. Marquez was using the qualifying session as a way to set up for the race, because he wasn't, going to gain anything out of actually, going out on softer tires and using a qualifying setup. Meanwhile, they don't have qualifying tires, but they do change their setups. Meanwhile, Alex De Angelis, who has been just charging in terms of the last few rounds. Took pole, but there was a surprise. There was a surprise in yes.
And he took pole and won last year.
Yes, we knew he was going to do well here, but the surprise was Mike DiMeglio and Yuki Takahashi were second and third, then Scott Redding, then Keenan Sofwaglu, who has been kind of a downward spiral all year. So that was great to see. Paul Espargaro, Bradley Smith, and only then. We had Stefan Bradl and Thomas Lutie. Now, this was one of the weirdest qualifying sessions I've ever seen, because it was like they went out, they just started to get into the rhythm. Scott Redding set a fast lap. It started raining. Now, you've already got – everybody has a time set. Bradl was eighth. Everybody's got a time set. They're not going to go out on wets, because what's the point, right? Riders will go out on wets to test their race setup in case it's going to be a wet race. But that's the only reason why you go out at that point. You've already set a lap that you're not going to be able to beat on wets, so why risk anything? But then the rain stops, so they go out again. And everybody starts setting fast lap after fast lap. Bradl has a great... lap, but he was at the top of the chart. I was like, oh man, boy, did he like dodge the bullet there, because this is such a huge opportunity for him to pull ahead in the championship, right? With Marquez starting from the back, and if he was on pole, it'd be freaking amazing for him. But
I think. But one point you should make, Jules, is that when the rain did stop, they basically had like 7.5 minutes to get back out, and it was in keeping with your theme of a crazy qualifying. It was a mad scramble to get guys back out.
Well, hang on a second. You're jumping ahead, because it happened twice. Because they went out in the middle, and then it started raining again. But then at the very end, it stopped raining again, and it once again had a chance to get fast laps. But Bradle ran out of time. He literally ran out of time by like less than a tenth of a second. He was about to cross the finish line when the timer went to zero. So that was his last good lap. And meanwhile, there were still guys, and he was, I think, at the top. But then the riders that were still out there, boom, boom, boom. Thomas Luthi, you know, obviously De Angelis. Actually, no, Thomas Luthi was from earlier. Thomas Luthi pipped him in that middle dry period. So during basically 55 minute session, we had rain. I mean, we had dry rain very short dry, then 20 minutes of rain, very short dry, 20 minutes of rain, and then very short dry. So it was just wild. It was just wild. I've never seen anything like it. And, you know, Bradle ended up in eighth as a result in qualifying, which made for a difficult start for him. So the race got underway, and by the end of lap one, Marquez, who had started from the back, was in 17th place. I watched that start, and, you know, you have to realize that these guys are using the same engines, right? And I don't care how many conspiracy theories you throw about Marquez and the backing he has. He doesn't have a better motor on that bike than anybody else. He just really, it's timing. It's knowing how to keep the front end down. A lot of inexperienced riders in the back. He just cut through them. So right away, he was more than halfway done with his passing in this race, you know, at the end of lap one.
My personal thought is that the overflow bottle, which actually feeds back into the radiator, they give it a small jolt of nitrous oxide, which hold past
nice.
and indeed charge up the crankcase. I mean, just a small advantage, but you never know. Some of these things are pretty hardcore.
Wow, that's an interesting point. Is this also where the mechanical seagull flew in?
Yeah, I need to get my tinfoil hat is on the other side of the room.
Bradle did not have a good start, because he finished that one in seventh, and it was Scott Redding up front with Paul Espargaro. Then Paul Espargaro was up front, and Bradle very quickly attacked the front guys. And took the lead with De Angelis in pursuit. But De Angelis was looking very dangerous, and they had a fantastic battle. Martin put a really interesting note in here, which is to say, and they did show this quite a few times, that the pit board that Bradle's team was giving him was constantly showing him where Marc Marquez was. Mm-hmm. And because they don't give you that much information, they weren't saying much about anybody else. You know, he knew that De Angelis was right there because he's seen a wheel or two. But they were just basically giving him information about where Marquez was. And I agree with Martin. That is not necessarily the best idea. First of all, it's demoralizing, right, to see Marquez cutting through the field, knowing your lead is shrinking. He's now in the points. He's now, you know, take 5 points further, you know, because he's thinking in terms of championship points in his head. But also, there's other information that he would like to know. Like, for example, that Claudio Corti and Paul Espargaro were, you know, not too far behind. Eventually, they didn't he ended up, he and Dean were having such a better pace that nobody really was circulating near them. But I think Brattle is a very composed guy, but he's a young guy, and he's, you know, anyway, I don't want to spend too much time with that.
Yeah, you're wandering down the garden.
Yeah, exactly. But the fight they had with Dean was amazing because Dean was like a gangster at the end. You know, he was sitting there,
yeah, no doubt,
knowing full well where he was going to take Brattle. And to Brattle's credit, he didn't completely lose his head, because even though he ran into the back of Dean's bike, almost ran into the back of Dean's bike. Did they actually touch in the Southern Loop in the last lap?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a solid punt. And frankly, with probably 90% of other racers that would have ended up with Brattle or Racer X hitting the tarmac and skittering out in the kitty litter.
Yeah.
That was one move that I said, I mean, I can understand why, because it's an additional 5 points in your pocket in the championship race. But at the same time, and he can't, I wish you could see my hands, because I'm actually drawing this in my head, but yeah, because I can actually see where he came across. DeAngelis took the corner a little bit wider than Brattle did. Brattle thought he saw an opening, backed off, but not enough. And they certainly did touch wheels. And, it's a great thing for, frankly, both DeAngelis and Brattle that it did not end up in both them going down, because that would have turned the championship not only on its head, Jules, but made a bit of a, and it's not like I'm saying this, but a bit of a mockery of the penalty situation.
Yes, yeah, I'm glad you bring that up, actually, because I want to talk about that a little later on, but go ahead, keep going, sorry.
And so it was brilliant that they pulled that off. And at that point, because Brattle lost a lot of time going way wide, that was out of Hondo, right?
Where? No, it was just...
I believe it was out of Honda Corner.
I thought it was Southern Loop. Because they had just gone through with Dean leading. They went into Doohan's, and then they were taking a left, weren't they?
It was somewhere on the Phillip Island.
There we go. What I was going to say is that the overwhelming majority of people who were watching that were saying Brattle stupid, right, to re-attack Dean. But I don't think that it was really that quite the way it happened. I think basically Dean is a very DeAngelis is a very smart rider, and he cut the place, he cut into the place where Brattle was going to be. He basically shut the door on him, so it would have been just it was just one of those things where, like, they both aimed for the same spot, and DeAngelis took it by surprise. It wasn't an idiot move or anything like that. I haven't seen Brattle do anything idiotic yet this season, so.
Well,
it could have ended in tears.
Well, yeah, certainly every race, good, and especially the battles for the front as the championship lead is, you know, winding down.
Meanwhile, Mark McKee.
I've kind of had my grumbles against DeAngelis for the last few years for a multitude of reasons, but. There have been flashes of brilliance this year, and I found myself for the last two laps rooting him on to get back or stay in front of Brattle to keep the championship close. Now, Jules, imagine if, yet another what if, the contact with the rear tire of DeAngelis took both of them out and Marquez won. And that was not that far from happening.
No, that's so actually, before you finish that thought, let's just go through what happened to Marquez, because Marquez was Just cutting through the ranks. And by lap 10, he was in fifth. And by lap 12, he was fourth. And by 17, he was third, and he stayed in third. He wasn't going to catch those guys, but I just wanted to make sure that progression was known, so that for those last eight laps, he was already in third, which means that anything that happened up front, either one of those guys falling would have changed the situation dramatically.
Marquez benefited greatly from a fair amount of guys going out, and that's not that unusual in Moto2.
Absolutely, absolutely. We had probably about nine guys that had DNFs. First of all, I think that if Marquez had not, if there hadn't been the incident with Rutherford Willerath and no penalty, this is exactly what the podium would have been anyway, because Brettel and Dean had a much better pace than Marquez. He would have never caught them, but he definitely had the pace to be in third, obviously. So in this really strange way, Marquez was not affected at all by any of this stuff. He finished with where he would have finished. Now, the interesting thing about the points here was that Marquez came in leading with by 1 point. If Brettel had won this race, then he would have gained 9 points on Marquez, which means he would have been. I'm thinking of the battle between Claudio Corti and Marquez, because Claudio Corti really gave Marquez a hard time all the way to the very end. And if Brettel had won the race and Corti had taken third and Marquez been in fourth, that would have meant that Brettel would have taken back 12 points. Right?
Yep.
With me?
Yep.
Which means that he would have been 11 points going into Sepang. With 11 points going into Sepang, it would mean that even if Marquez won the next two races, all that Brettel would have to do is finish second. In Sepang and Valencia, he would be the champion. With Corti passing, with Marquez passing Corti, that went down to 8 points coming out of Phillip Island for Brettel. Now, this is still Brettel winning the race, which means that if Marquez wins the next two races, no matter what Brettel does, he loses the championship. And we know that Marquez is capable of doing that, winning the last two races of Sepang and Valencia. So that pass between Corti and Marquez was critical in that point situation. But of course, with De Angelis winning, it doesn't really make a difference, because now we're coming out of the championship with just 3 points, and Brettel's got his work cut out because it's Marquez who's on the roll. There, that's what I want to say. And you know, we have to talk about the fact that you know, Marquez is in a bit of a privileged rider. He has the backing of the biggest sponsor. He has the backing of the frame manufacturer. I believe he's the only one still actually who's actually racing on the 2012 chassis. There are other teams that are starting to test with the 2012 chassis, but he's the only one who's actually already racing on it, and it's working for him, because we could tell when he went out on the 2011 chassis, he was struggling. And part of it was the settings, having to adjust the settings from the 2012 setting back to the 2011. But he certainly would have had more trouble.
True. Let me pause you for a moment and point out that Scott Running was running a 2012 chassis this weekend. Sorry.
Well, I'll redact that then. There was a great comment that Todd Grice, who's a listener to the show for many years and a big fan and a really excellent duo. Him and Nick Grice are racers in the AFM and AMA. And this is what he said on we had a long thread about qualifying and the race in Moto2.
Yep.
It's in like 40 something comments. So, but Todd wrote, it seems like it's the same racing formula across many series. The talent level in Moto2 is pretty insanely close. 1 second covered the top 15 and 5 seconds covered the entire field. This is in qualifying. The teams are all capable of taking apart and putting together a motorcycle between sessions. The deciding factor at that point comes down to budget and who is able to put X amount of dollars into every detail to tip the scales in their favor. It's tough to blame Suter for taking Marquez's input on the chassis and not selling it to anyone else. He is in the business of selling chassis, and when Marquez's teams approached him, I doubt it was a, hey, I'll build you this bitchin' chassis out of the kindness of my heart scenario. A budget like his team had their head, there surely was a contract involved to ensure that only Marquez got this chassis, built to his specifications, and in return, Suter would be compensated for not having to build numerous bitchin' chassis for the rest of the class. It's Racing Economics 101. When things get close, break out the checkbook. I love that last line. And of course, you know, you're blowing Todd out of the water too with your Scott Redding thing. But Mark VDS is also a team with very deep pockets, as we mentioned earlier. So it kind of boils down to that, even though there was a time where Brattle was leading the championship by a massive amount of points, he is definitely the underdog for the remainder of the season. And this was his big chance to get a huge boost in the championship hopes. And, you know, it's nice that he comes out leading the championship again, but it was I'm sure he was disappointed. And you could tell this was the first time during his interviews where he was stumbling over words, because I think that that what he really wanted to say was fuck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And one thing I will note in the comment that Todd made is I highly doubt there's something in the contract that actually says that only Marquez would get the chassis. That's the kind of things that you do on a handshake and a backdoor deal.
That's true.
Yeah. The circumstances surrounding Redding's team, Mark VDS Racing, getting the 2012 chassis, I'm sure that it's select few people that actually know how that came to be. But that being said, if I can pull this back a little bit, we know that Mark VDS was earlier on in testing considering running the BMW with the Suter chassis. And they kind of backed off from that, even though it seemed to be making some progress, albeit fairly more far back than some people would like a CRT chassis engine combination to be. And they have been grumbling all year about it, so it's not surprising to me that Eskil Suter finally, you know, tipped his hat and said, hey, give this a shot, see what you can do with it.
Right. Take a big breath. Let's go with MotoGP.
All right, give it a shot.
Which was again, you know, lots of drama, unfortunately of a different kind, because I can't remember the last time that a factory team fielded no riders in a GP race. You know, certainly before I started watching GPs.
Yeah,
or at least you know, may have missed something somewhere, but certainly not in the last decade or so.
All right, so that's a challenge to you listeners out there. Let us know the last time a fully funded factory team did not have both riders out of a race, and list the names and the reasons why.
Cool. All right. So because Ben Spies had a crash during qualifying, and obviously we talked about earlier, Jorge Lorenzo had that nasty injury that he sustained in warm up, and it was the exactly same place. They both fell in exactly the same place. You know, just that Ben fell a little bit earlier, just coming out of doing it. It was a very strange fall, and he had a concussion, and there was some tweets going on Twitter saying that that he actually broke a rib, and but I haven't been able to confirm that. I know he definitely banged up his rib cage, so he was having trouble sitting on the bike, and but the big problem was the concussion, because he actually even said like he just wasn't able to concentrate, so they pulled him out, and obviously Lorenzo was not going to ride after the warm up, So Yamaha didn't have anybody out there, which is a shame because I really did not expect. I really expected Honda to dominate this weekend, and once again, Lorenzo was up there. He qualified second. The big surprise of qualifying was Alvaro Bautista qualifying fourth. Who did he get a tow from? I forget. Was it Dovi? I think he was behind Dovi.
Believe so.
There was a lot of angry. There was a lot of anger during qualifying. Actually, there was a lot of riders who were, getting toes and even, you know, the perennial nice guys, Nicky Hayden, Ben Spies, I think even Edwards were getting seriously pissed. There were shots of them, you know, waving their fists, and we're not always sure who it was, but anyway, Bautista got a tow from, I believe, Dovizioso, and
yeah,
and
I was just going to say the one guy that didn't actually complain, or maybe perhaps he was not aware, or thought that Bautista could keep the pace. That benefited Alvaro and the Suzuki squad to some serious effect, because he ended up on the second row.
Yeah, but you know, obviously Casey Stoner took pole. It was not a big surprise. But Jorge Lorenzo had second. Marco Simoncelli was up there in third. He hasn't been on the front row for a while, so that was nice to see. Then Bautista, Dovizioso, Nicky Hayden, which is nice to see. Ben Spies, Danny Pedrosa, kind of a surprise down there in eighth. Colin Edwards, Lois Caparossi, 10th, one of the better qualifying efforts from him. He actually insisted on coming to this race because he's had so many great races here in the past, and I think that there was a little bit of a conversation with his doctors because originally there was talk that he wasn't going to make this round. Randy DePugne, Hiroshi Aoyama, Valentino Rossi was 13th, not good. Cal Crutchlow, who was not getting along with the Bridgestones at this track. Cale Abraham and Tony Elias, and the name that's missing here, which is a real shame because we were really looking forward to seeing him out here, was Barbara's replacement, Damian Cudlin.
Yeah, and he managed to tear a whole bunch of skin off of his hip, and certainly not something you'd want to go into a MotoGP race weekend, regardless of the fact that you're at your home track. But he certainly felt like he had something to prove after his crash at Motegi. And, it's an opportunity to give, you know, some new riders or riders that have an up-and-coming, you know, potential, especially with the CRT teams coming in. Although, Jules, excuse me, I thought it was interesting that Damian Cullen has been doing the testing on the Sitter BMW bike and was invited in to run with the Carol Abraham squad. Help me out here. Hector Barbera Primec? Squad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Aspar.
On a Ducati when he'd already had time running with the potential CRT candidate for next year. That's something you don't see very often.
That's a good point. Well, that first happened when he went to Motegi to replace Loris. So he was already on a Ducati then. This one kind of made a little more sense because he's already been on a Ducati. But yeah, I see what you're saying. Race-wise, Casey Stoner took off.
Although he did lay some hellacious slides.
Yeah.
Better over the years.
Absolutely. I mean, it was what we were waiting for because, you know, this is the fifth time in a row that he's won this at the circuit. It was so cool to watch him.
And on his birthday, no less.
And on his birthday, that's right. So, he won a championship. Obviously, by winning this race, so won the race, won the championship on his birthday. Awesome. On home ground, couldn't be better for him. super happy for the guy. Obviously, we've given him grief in the past. I'm not going to forget the fact that he punched another rider out on track early this year. But, you know, he's been riding like one of the best riders in history and obviously deserves the championship. He won it hands down. He has never been off the podium except for once, which was in Jerez.
Yeah.
And that was courtesy of Rossi.
We would be remiss if we didn't mention the two rainstorms that occurred during the race, but certainly the one that occurred with about three laps left to go.
Well, so we did get rain at the very end of the race, and two riders actually opted to go back in and get rain tires because, you know, if it suddenly starts pouring, hey, being the first guy out there on wets might be the good thing. So Nicky Hayden went in, and I believe Depunier. No, not Depunier. Was it Depunier?
Yes, I believe it was. Yeah.
Okay. And of course, we had this the Marco Simoncelli Andrea Dovizioso battle, which was kind of funny because it was at first I was like, oh, just I can't wait to see the Andrea Dovizioso Danny Pedrosa battle because they're actually fighting for third place in the championship and they're very close. But then Marco Simoncelli and Pedrosa kind of tangled for a little bit. Simoncelli got past him, went on to catch Dovizioso. And that was good because there was back and forth there for sure. And Dovizioso was leading into the last lap, but then Simoncelli took him and took second. So,
yeah, and indeed, we also had gentleman, unfortunately, that headed out, which looked very promising, was Bautista. He got caught up by the rainstorm.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right, exactly. Yeah, when he went down, there was like water going with him. So, obviously, there was water on the track. There were parts of the track were dry. This typical Phillip Island craziness, you know. Parts of the track were dry, parts of it were wet. And he got caught out. And the other rider the first rider actually that went down was Rossi, and it was not due to rain, because the other three guys that went down were all rain, all in the same lap actually. But Valentino Rossi passing in his favorite place, he was passing Bautista actually of all people, in MZ Corner for fourth. What would have been fifth, I think. And but he crashed there. And was unable to restart. But the only other three crashers were Bautista, Ayama, and Crutchlow, and they all went down the exact same lap. We ended up with just 10 finishers because with the Yamaha team not starting, with Damien Cudlin not starting, we had a 14-rider field grid, and then four riders out, so 10 riders finished. That's a record. That, again, I can't remember the last time, although I think somebody said that in 1991 there was a race where only seven riders finished.
I think if you really wanted to be honest about it, you would have to count the number of riders that finished on the last lap that actually were not lapped. And I bet it would be a fair bit smaller than 10.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right. You're right. So, championship won by Casey Stoner, as we mentioned. Jorge Lorenzo is not going to be racing at Sepang, but he is going to be racing at Valencia. There's a mathematical chance that Dovizioso could catch him if he won both races, and Jorge did not score points, or not score big points anyway. The battle to watch, I think, is for third, Danny Pedrosa and Dovizioso, because Dovizioso is leaving the team and would love to finish. This would be like the one final fuck you to Honda. As he moves to Tech Trois next year.
The bottom line for Lorenzo is he only has to finish, 14th or better in order to take the second place. So in the next race is coming up. Obviously, Malaysia is out of the equation, but it's not going to take much to garner up 2 points, and he would certainly take it if they were tied at that point.
And Dovizioso still has to win, and he's not going to because Casey Stoner, Danny Pedrosa, you know. like we said, it's a mathematical shot that Dovizioso has, but he's much more keen on beating Pedrosa than Lorenzo. Well, it certainly would be a fantastic way for him to finish his career with the factory team of Repsol Honda to be second after all the you know kind of crap that he had to put up with them. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to be between third and fourth.
I'm totally willing to go out on a limb with the entire majority of Motopod lings out there and say that I'd be happy to put $5 on Lorenzo to take second place. And if you want to bet with me on that,
what kind of odds are you giving?
Obviously,
he's going to take second, so you got to get some odds.
My personal odds, probably somewhere in the region of, I'll say about 60-1 because.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So you're going to pay out somebody, you're going to pay out $300 if they send in $5 and Dovizioso takes second?
No, I'm not. I'm just saying the general odds of it actually occurring. I'm not a Vegas bookie, Jules.
All right. And we probably are not allowed to do this since we're in the U.S. All right. So let's. yeah. You guys know his email address. You know how to get in touch with Jim. Marcus Simoncelli finishing second means that he now passes Valentino Rossi in the standings. He doesn't pass him. They're tied on points. It's just that Simoncelli has had a couple of seconds. He's had 1 second, and Rossi has had a third. So is ahead of him based on that. Nicky Hayden's still there at 132. So look out for sixth place battle as well at the next two rounds. Very very quick. I want to do a Sepang preview. I think that we need to be looking at a good battle between Pedrosa and Dovizioso. Pedrosa was, I think, kind of gained a huge amount of respect after being kind of poo-pooed for a lot of the 2006 season because he rode. Sepang is not an easy track to ride. It's a fairly physical track. And he had a totally busted up ankle, and he ended up finishing on the podium, third in 2006. And he was third in 2007 and top Michelin. This was the beginning of the Michelin gate. He was second in 2008 and 2009, and he missed the race, obviously, last year because in Motegi he crashed and broke his collarbone, and this was one of the rounds he missed. Dovizioso also has a really great record here. He was second here last year, and he almost actually beat Valentino Rossi. He was running in third in 2009 but crashed, and he was third in 2008. That was when he was with the Scott team, so that was a great result. It was his first podium in MotoGP. So with third position on the line in the championship and those two guys having a really good record here at Sepang, and they'll be fighting for second probably with Casey Stoner on form. That should be a good battle to watch. Hopper's coming back for this race. Really stoked to see what kind of ride he's going to give us given what he's got to be hungry after the you know 6/1000ths of a second loss of the BSB championship. And this is his one last hurrah for the year, I believe. And then, of course, Ayama and Simoncelli have some history here, so them being on the same team should prove interesting, although obviously Simoncelli has the upper hand with the factory Honda. This is also the place where Rossi had his last wing, which was last year, obviously, in Sepang. Was this the last time that Rossi stood at the top of the podium?
I believe so. And there was a lot of speculation about who might end up on Jorge's bike for Sepang, and a lot of people were like, give it to Colin, give him a shot to potentially get his win.
His one, yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is that Colin has never done well at this track. I think the best he's ever done was like an eighth.
But you know, he never had I take that all back. He's never had a factory Yamaha here. Or at least one that
he has. Of course he has.
Did he have a factory Yamaha at Sepang? I guess
Okay. When he was Rossi's teammate.
Well, he never had a 2011 factory Yamaha at Sepang, did he?
Yes, that's true.
There were other names tossed out. One of which was Laverty. Not going to work. He's tested in Aprilia. Mark Melandri, nope, not going to work. He's already signed with BMW. So who do you bring up? Well, Yamaha, much as the Japanese factories often do, brought up one of their test riders, Japanese Superbike Championship from 2008 and 2009, Katsuyuki Nakasuga. Not a name that we've heard real often.
He's been a wild card before.
Yes, he has been a wild card.
In 250s, not in MotoGP.
Yep. But not the name a lot of people were looking for, but it is what it is, and we'll give them an opportunity to barrel more points together for the Constructors' Championship, though I believe that is already decided at this point with Honda. So,
yeah.
It really
they could still win the team.
Well, it's all about mathematics, isn't it, Jules?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's not going to happen.
As Barbie once said, math is hard.
Moto 2, again, De Angelis. I think it's going to be De Angelis, Luthi, and Iannone because they were good here last year. De Angelis was second. Luthi was third, fighting with Iannone for third and crashed. But. Was third, and the race was won last year by Robbie Rolfo, who obviously was in Superbikes this year.
And to be honest, frankly, surprised the shit out of everybody with that win.
Yeah, exactly, including himself, I think. And we can't compare Brattle's finish because he was crappy at a lot of tracks last year. And this year he's a completely new rider, a completely new team. They really figuring stuff out. But Marquez won in the 125s, won from pole position at Sepang, so he feels very confident going in. So that's obviously Marquez, Brattle are going to be up there as well, and Dean Luthi and Iannone are going to be the spoilers. And in the 125s, like we mentioned earlier, all Turrell has to do is finish ahead of Zarco. And he was third here last year. Zarco was 11th, but again, it's the same situation as Brattle. We hardly even heard Zarco's name last year, and this year he's a championship contender. So, I would also be on the lookout for Vasquez again, who obviously does not care about Zarco unless the team speaks with him. And he finished strong last year. I think he was fourth. And we got to take into account that Sepang is another one of those tracks that can throw some crazy weather at us.
No doubt. No doubt. We've seen, qualifying race or rained out before. So,
right.
Certainly a bit of a crapshoot.
And it's sweltering hot right now, which means that the thunderstorms are on the way.
Yeah. Although, dear friend of the show, Andrew Wheeler, has been posting some delicious pictures of the pool outside of his cabana. Or whatever you call it in Malaysia, bastard. It's definitely going to be a grueling race.
Cool. All right. Your turn. World Superbikes.
World Superbike. Bit of silly season news. Definitely confirmed that Hiroshi Aoyama will be going to Tenkata World Superbike this year to team up with Johnny Ray. And Jules is now more able to spell that last name right. Three letters. It's not very complex, but there were some really good points made on the Eurosport broadcast. One that Tenkata, of course, and they've already done so, will be using a more sophisticated electronics package with the new Fireblade for next year. And thing is, Johnny's not got a whole bunch of experience with the newer systems, but Hiroshi's coming from MotoGP, so that might give him a little bit of a leg up. We'll have to see. It'll also give HRC an opportunity to kind of figure out if, because Johnny's kind of been one of those guys, Jules, that's been, you know, floating on the tipping point to bring him into GP. A chance to bump up against a guy that has had some wins, certainly a 2010 or 2009 250 GP champion, that being Hiroshi Ayama. So might be some good synergy in that team. What do you think?
Oh, totally. Absolutely.
Yep. So I have to see how we can do against him. You know, maybe if he's consistently beating him, might give him a chance to pop him up. If not, he might stay down in World Superbike. It'll be interesting, you know, Jules, World Superbike next year, and I wonder how much of this is influenced by the fact that Bridgepoint, the owner now of both Infront Motorsports and Dorna, but World Superbike next year is going to 17-inch tires, or wheels. Tires and wheels, of course. That'd be a trick if they went 16.5 rims with 17-inch tires. But it might slow the bikes down a little bit. There's a very specific reason that they've been running 16.5s for a long time. Same reason they're running the same thing in MotoGP currently. You know, I
know where you're going. Do you think that they're slowing them down so that the CRTs are faster?
Maybe, but on the other hand, well, yeah, of course, that's a very open rules package for the CRTs as far as chassis go, which, of course, includes wheels. They may very well be doing so, but at the same time, I think part of it is a push which has been intended for some time to try and rein in not only costs within the World Superbike paddock, and as we know that they'll be going to a single bike next year for the riders, a quote-unquote single bike, but will also give Pirelli, frankly, the opportunity to not so much focus on, on a purebred race tire that nobody on the roads is going to be running, the 16.5, but the 17, which are what bikes are being shipped with these days. So, just a little factoid there, something to brew over in your mind. What else going on in World Superbike? Troy Corser, not unsurprisingly, has announced his retirement after 17 years. Got two World Superbike titles and some great races. 33 race wins, 377 races.
Wow.
That being said, according to Jack Bernicle, so anything might be the actual figure, because a man can actually call every corner turn six. But that being said, the Troy I've met off track on occasions will certainly be probably around. And is always certainly the last to retire. So,
wow.
Well done, you, Troy. Fantastic career. I wish you the best of luck in whatever endeavors that you're heading out to in the future. Very, very cool, but also sad to see a gentleman heading out, especially one that was so instrumental in getting the BMW to be a competitive package. So, interesting. We had a whole bunch of rumors, and a whole bunch of them actually was kind of solidified into what is a bit of a still amorphous gel, if you will. That was a swig of my Foster's, folks. Carlos Checa, there was a whole bunch of waffling that went on over the last few days, and we heard he'd signed for BMW. We'd heard that he signed for a factory. A full factory ride in World Superbike with Ducati Corse. So we heard at the very last minute that, and this was, interestingly enough, this was after race one between the two races they were running at Portimao this last weekend. He heard after race one that the contract had been signed, which is a trick when the rider is actually out on course, that he was going to... Well, I'm just saying, you know, he rides very relaxed, Jules. He may have had a, you know, piece of duct tape on there. They pasted over the center.
What but, a great image.
I am picturing that, and I think he'd frankly have the opportunity to do so.
He's adding plus 100,000,
you know. Yeah, he might have actually had
to
a
his salary.
had a calculator built into his onboard dash that was manipulable by a foot switch somewhere.
But, plus.
We really had no idea. And then Effenberg, or I'm sorry, not Effenberg, Altea Ducati put out a press release a little bit post-race that affirmed that that was indeed the case. We still have a bunch, though, of silly season stuff going on. Eugene Laverty on the Tuesday following Portimao, that being yesterday or the day before, whenever you're listening to this, went out and tested on the Aprilia, and he came, his lap time was immediately very positive, and he actually ran a great time. Word was that he was running actually Biaggi's race bike with a plain white fairing. So we'll have to see how that goes. So, back to Altea, you know, it's going to be kind of funny. Effenberg Liberty has been a team that's come strong, and especially we'll talk about in a brief form in the upcoming race review from Portimao. But good stuff. And
you know, actually, did you notice that Elias was running their livery at Phillip Island? So they sponsored. This is like Lucio Cicinello has always been the master of like getting sponsors for an event, you know, rather than an entire season. So they actually ran the same exact livery that we've seen all year World Superbikes with little bubbles, you know, the effervescent F and Bert Liberty bubbles. So that was cool to see.
Yep, and perhaps those bubbles led to the fact that he did put the bike on the tarmac in the race and actually got a decent finish.
And he didn't finish last either.
Yeah, indeed. It will be fun to watch and see what's going to be coming around. There have still been mentions of Park and Go, formerly of Triumph, formerly of Yamaha, potentially running Ducati. We'll still have to see. Got no idea if that's a done deal. Knowing us and our luck, I'll wake up first thing in the morning and there'll be a signed deal, or Yamaha will pull something out of their hat for World Super Sport, or frankly World Superbike. Well, Yamaha, you know, Jules, is going to be a lot like Ducati was a couple of years ago, or this year, where they bounced out as a full sponsor, quote unquote, but still provided factory machines to at least one rider and perhaps a whole bunch of factory bits to another rider.
Right.
Will that happen next year for Yamaha? Who knows? But with the success that they've had, you got to kind of wonder. And on top of that, take away that we haven't seen any real major revisionary bumps from both the R6 and especially the R6, judging from the fact that Lucas Scassa and Chaz Davis were running 2009 R6s, originally belonging to who was it? It was Cal Crutchlow and Fabian Fore in 2009. And those,
wow,
you know, those bikes were at the top of the pops and won a bunch of races and ultimately won a world championship. So that's another factor, Jules, of the economy, is that bike an acceleration of technology in bikes is kind of slowed in a way, because if people aren't buying bikes, well, what's the point of updating your bikes with the newest GWiz technology right now if people aren't buying it and aren't willing to pay the additional premium to support that? So a bit of silly season stuff. The FIM has put out a revised I will not call finalized calendar for World Superbike for 2012. Running down the list, Phillip Island, Imola, Assen, Jules' favorite circuit, Monza, Donington, Miller, Misano, Aragon, Brno, Silverstone, Moscow, which, damn it, I'm going to make somehow or another. Nürburgring, Portimao, and actually moved back from the end of the year, which I think is kind of a shame. And then finally, Magny-Cours, which you thought was interesting how they named our corners.
Well, I think it's fitting that it's the last race just because of the way they named their corners, because they named their corners after famous racetracks.
Indeed.
Or corners in at famous racetracks.
Well, they're the French. They can't always come up with something original. Uh-oh. Anyway. Yet another tick mark on my horrid email coming in. You know, the championships for both Superbike and Supersport had been previously decided at the prior round, much to the surprise of the Algarve Circuit, who's out a newsletter saying, hey, everything's going to be decided here. But, you know, Jules, I really don't want to wander through these races. You and I are already probably hitting the hour and a half mark or hour 45 minutes at this point. I think the one standout that I want to so let me give you the top three in both races, and then we'll chat about it for a bit. Top three in World Superbike race one at Portimao: Checa Guintoli, Jonathan Rea, following up with Biagio, who scores Melandri, etc. Race two would have been Melandri, Laverty, and Rea, followed up closely by Checa Guintoli, Camier. The guy that actually struck me as the star of these races, frankly, in a way, especially considering that the season in essence and in fact was over at the prior race. It was no Valencia, because frankly, we always like watching around for Portimao. Was Guintoli. Sylvain kicked ass this prior weekend. And very, very fun to watch. Kept it gathered up. Impressed on how he's come back as hard as he has from his prior season in BSB and doing really well on the Effenberg team when he'd gotten so racked up from the crash that he was involved with on a warm-up lap, no less, with Josh Brooks. So, well done. Guys that went out on these two races, certainly in race one, it was a bit more of a crash fest. He ended up with, scroll perfectly, Javier Forrest in race one there. I think there were some additional ones, but our final standings, and certainly there's no doubt that the mad Spaniard Carlos Checa locked up this year with a massive 110-point gap down to Marco Melandri. Not a bad idea for Biagio to come back and make sure he put in a standing to, defend and his third place position. You know, a fitting end to the season. The weather seemed to be holding out at Portimao, and it doesn't always do so, being a coastal circuit. I'm looking for next year. You know, we had Jules. We had a bit of the same situation in Supersport, where the race was already decided. But I think there were a lot of guys, and this is what we get, and we'll get at this even more as MotoGP winds down over the next couple of races.
People riding for contracts.
Yeah, guys racing for contracts. I mean, there's talk of Tony Elias, for example, who has had a couple of successful rounds in the past, a very short past with MotoGP, as that seems to happen as the season winds down. I can't understand why. But, he may have a plum ride in Moto2 going back there. Same thing with the guys here in both the Superbike, Supersport, and frankly, the super stock classes as well, where we've seen some great battles this year. We had all the journalists out on Monday, punters, if you will, doing all the testing, which they do every year. But then again, one of those guys that actually ran there was former Canadian Superbike champion Brett McCormick from this year, who won the Superbike champion on, I believe, a BMW S1000R. They invited him back on Tuesday. They said, hey, you're pretty quick on that thing. You want to come out and run for the team? And he only ran like a second and a half or something off. Well done. You know, us Americans are kind of clamoring for an American in World Superbike. And I think we'll adopt a Canadian if we have to.
Yeah.
Backing up on Super Sport.
Yeah, and we, come on, we got to mention Ellison. He finished third in the race, and after his massive surge in BSB as well, so he finished the season on a super high, and so huge kudos to him.
Yeah, I was just going to run down the podium and the rest of the guys in Super Sport. Your top three guys in the box were Chaz Davis, Davis Salome, who has also been coming on. And frankly, it's heartening to me to see Kawasaki's up there at the front of the grid.
Yeah.
And James Ellison
on a
dry day on the pseudo satellite PTR Bogdanka team, under Simon, and great job all you guys out there. I think Brains is actually his crew chief. I don't know if that's changed around a bit, but well done, Lucas Gasson fourth, and then walking on through the rest of the grid, including a tip of the hat to Miguel Praia, who on his home circuit managed to pull in an eighth
there, right? And to my man Skopek, who scored a point.
Yeah, and also, you know, kind of a bit of a well, yeah. I'll just not go there. Yeah, Skopek, of course, your hometown rider, right?
Yep.
Yep. Wow. So the end of the season four, of course, World Supersport, Chaz Davis with his win there, finished out 50 on top. Well done. I think the one thing that probably rankled anybody in this race was Fabien Foure slipped out of second spot, and knowing the ferret, that probably pissed him off pretty badly. And David Salome took that over Brock Parks, Lucas Casas, Sam Lowes, James Ellison, Florian Marino, and on and on. World Superbike next year should be pretty kick-ass, and I'm frankly looking forward to it. Even with the changes and also BSB, we've got everything's been tossed in a blender for next year, Jules. Once again.
It's a different kind of blender, but every year it's a different kind of blender. But for some reason,
I think at this point we've actually become more tolerant of the blender.
It's true. I think that the only weirdness this year is that all of the top MotoGP guys already had contracts for next year, and that's what really held things back for so long. Because normally that stuff starts to happen like in the summertime, and because the Superbikes has been going on for a while. The big factor in the Superbikes has been nobody knows which, who's going to provide bikes, I think why the blender is kind of crazy this year, because it's not just the riders, where the riders are going to be, but who's going to be available to give them a ride. Even top guys. I mean, Melandri and Laverty brought Yamaha to the top of the championship pretty much, except for Cheka, and Yamaha's leaving. So it's, quote, leaving.
True. Yeah. Well, I think in the same vein, we can kind of look at the other, perhaps the top skim of the blender is going to be Moto3 for next year.
Yes.
It's going to, absolutely change the landscape. And you look at, no doubt, much like the CRTs, the first year is going to be a fair amount of teething pains. Mm-hmm. And we'll have to see what all the teams can pull out. Moto 3, I think we had the perfect model for Moto 2 last year, which you really knew, had no idea what anybody was going to be able to pull off, because very specifically, they all had standardized engines, ECUs, etc. Moto 3 is going to have a significantly advanced, more state of tune, but clearly, you know, Moto 3 in a way is also a CRT class, very clearly. You know, if you want the engine that those guys just ran, you can get it. And that's kind of been downplayed simply because it is.
Wait, there's actually a claiming rule?
Oh, yeah.
In Moto 3?
Well, no, anybody can buy anybody else's engines. Anybody. The teams have to support up to 15 riders each, those that come out with engine configurations.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that. Actually, I should take a look at those rules, because I'm sure we'll be talking about Moto 3 in full during the off season.
Yeah, no doubt. And I guess it's about time for me to get Mr. Suter back on the phone, isn't it?
It would be awesome. It would be awesome. He's got his fingers in so many places now.
So that is it, ladies and gentlemen. A long, rambling talk on what has happened this last week and what we got coming up. Jules, I don't think you have anything else. Are you ready to hit the sack and head back to real life?
Yeah. Let's get the music going, and we'll see you guys next week. And see you on Facebook and Twitter and all the other places where we meet virtually.
Cool. I believe this is my cue. Is this my cue?
Yeah.
Bum, 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 bum.
There we go. All right. Good night, Jim.
Later.
Did you notice that, by the way?
Damn you.
Oh, you motherfucker. You're doing it again.
Damn you.
No. You had a perfect opportunity. You were talking 125s, which I didn't see, and I told you I didn't see.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's so funny, dude. All right, I'm just going to keep going. That's so hilarious. I can't believe it. Every fucking week.
Hey, I found a spot that I thought was safe, and then I'm sitting there going, "Oh fuck, he's going to ask me a question."
Oh, yeah, that's too
you good. Should actually that would make a perfect outtake.